Hello and welcome to Fraud Talk, the ACFE's monthly podcast. I'm Mason Wilder, Research Director at the ACFE, and I'm joined by Andy McNeil, our Vice President of Education, to talk to you about the 2024 Report to the Nations, or as we should say, the full title, Occupational Fraud 2024, a Report to the Nations.
We're thrilled to announce this exciting new publication by the ACFE. Mason and I have some insights to share with you today, both about sort of behind the scenes looks into how we create this report and some of the exciting findings from this year's study.
We thought we'd start off with just giving a brief history or some additional context for the audience. If you're newer to the ACFE or haven't been consuming these reports all along. And since Andy has been here and been involved with the report much longer than myself, I am going to let her cover that.
So the first report was published back in 1996. I actually joined the ACFE in 2004. And I've been working on them since then, but the first report predated my tenure here even by a few years, 1996. Dr. Wells, our chairman and founder, published the first report, and it was basically his idea to provide this resource. He realized that the ACFE, because of our members, are in a very unique situation where we are able to shine a light on the true costs, methods, perpetrators and victims of occupational fraud in a way that no other group really can. We have the largest collection of anti-fraud professionals in the world at our fingertips in our membership. And so it was his idea to reach out to those individuals that are our members and ask them to share the insights that they were witnessing as part of their jobs, and to collect all of those insights and compile them into this really valuable resource. So 1996, it was a very small report compared to what it is today. It has grown immensely. We're now on our 13th edition of this study. We release it every 2 years. In 2010, we actually turned it from a U.S.-focused study to a global study. And this year's study, we have 1,921 cases of occupational fraud that was investigated during the prior two-year period. From all over the world. And it's been really fascinating over my tenure here to see how this report has evolved and how what Dr. Wells initially envisioned it being has continued to grow and provide so much value to our members and to the public and to the media.
Yeah, one little tidbit that I've always found interesting about it is that the original report is actually how the fraud tree that we put out or published that you've probably seen before, how that came to be, just because of sorting through the results of the first survey that was conducted on paper, by the way. But yeah, now here we are. We've gone from a report with like 19 pages to now we're at like 106 pages. And the initial one had like 11 charts or graphs. And now we've got about 114. And that's not even including the cool infographics that we started doing about three or four reports ago. This is only my second report to be a co-author on, but it's just a really cool thing. And a point of significant emphasis for our organization and the research department because we recognize the value that it provides people. So we thought we'd talk a little bit about the process to just give you a little behind the scenes peek at how it all comes to be. It's definitely a group effort with a lot of people putting a lot of time and care and, you know, energy into it. It starts off, it's about a year long process where we start working on the questions of the survey that becomes the basis for the report. And, you know, we work as a group to kind of spitball new ideas or whether or not we want to change how we're asking questions or add new questions. We added a handful of questions to this year's report. Then, of course, we send out the survey and collect responses. Once we get all those responses, we have to take them and export them. And there's, you know, I don't even know exactly the painstaking magic that goes into that. That's an Andy thing, not a Mason thing. So Andy does a great job taking all of that information and making it available to the rest of the team. So that, and then we have to go through and clean up. We go response by response and clean up the data in a way that it's all uniform. Like I'm sure many of you are aware of the data cleanup process in data analysis. Then, you know, we run those numbers, we put the charts together, and then we send them over to our design department, who does a great job making basic charts look really compelling and eye-popping and coming up with infographics. Then we, a team of, I think there's five of us this year as co-authors, write all the copy of the report from the foreword all the way to the end. And then we assemble all those various pieces in order and then go through about three or four rounds of review with many reviewers and editors. And that's how it all comes to be. Did I miss any part of the sausage making, Andy?
It's funny you mentioned the whole importing process, and that alone was, to me, kind of a flashpoint between knowing that the original report was sort of organized by stacks of paper that were submitted to us via snail mail, and now we've got all the technology behind the scenes. But I think the only thing I would add is that, you know, none of it would be possible if it weren't for the contributions of the thousands of CFEs that do participate in the study. So even before it becomes all the back and forth with all of our internal parties, we wouldn't have any of the material to even work with if it weren't for the thousands of CFEs that show up for us year after year and participate in this pretty lengthy survey. I mean, we had, what, over 80 questions, I think. So we know that it's a lot of work for us, but it also requires a lot for the participants. And we are so grateful to each and every one of them.
Yeah, I think it's really a testament to the anti-fraud community and their natural inclination to contribute to the profession as a whole so that everybody can do a better job fighting fraud. So that's a pretty unique aspect of our membership and our field that I've always been struck by and really impressed by. Not nearly as competitive as other fields that I've worked in or, you know, been exposed to. It's like we're all on the same team, and that's pretty cool. The only other distinction about the process that I felt like making is are worth pointing out is that this is about occupational fraud, not all fraud. So, you know, a shorter way to say it doesn't include some external frauds like consumer fraud or insurance fraud or, you know, account takeovers and social engineering and stuff like that, cyber fraud. This is really just focused on occupational fraud, which I know is disappointing to some of our members that really want to contribute cool cases that they've worked on. And but unfortunately, it is limited in scope somewhat to just occupational fraud. But we still, it's not so limited that we can't turn out a 100-plus page report on it.
Well, and part of the reason that we've made that distinction is that this is the one absolute risk that every single organization faces. We know that if you employ individuals, you have a risk of one of those employees committing fraud at some point. So this, in order to make this report as relevant to every single organization as we can, we have focused on just those occupational or inside fraud risks.
That is, thank you for adding that. That is a good point to add. And now we wanted to talk about some highlights from the actual report findings. So Andy, I'll let you kind of start off there.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, this is my 10th report I've worked on, and almost every time, you know, the first question people ask is, you know, what's new, what's interesting, what's different? And to me, what's new and what's different isn't even always the most interesting. I've actually been very struck over the years. One of the most interesting things to me is how absolutely consistent our data is from study to study. We have new things. We can talk about a bunch of those in a moment, but I wanted to start here by saying, study after study, we have certain things that just are really hallmarks of occupational fraud. We know right around 40% of occupational frauds are detected by tips year after year. I think it was, you know, 42 or 43% the last several studies. We hit 39% one time. That's about as wild as that that change has been. We know that most of those tips are coming from employees. Those are absolute trends that we see across all studies. And we saw them again this year. We know that most frauds are can be attributed to either a lack of internal controls or override of existing controls. At the same time, we also have data going back years and years and years that show that organizations that have anti-fraud controls in place catch frauds faster and suffer lower losses. So we have really great solid data that goes back. We've collected over 22,000 cases at this point over the life of this study. And if you look at all of those as an entire body of knowledge, we can extrapolate some pretty clear trends that that I think we can all really rely on when we're making cases for all different, you know, for management, for controls, for training, all of those different purposes. So for me, I think one of the big things I'm always encouraged by is the consistency. Mason, I'm sure you probably saw some of that as well.
Yeah, and it was, I remember the last report, my first one that I was involved in. I had been, warned, and I had looked at previous reports of, and not necessarily warned, but I had been made aware of those consistencies. But then getting into actually the data and the calculations and seeing it being like, down to the 10th or 100th decimal point of a percentage point, despite a different Wild. Amount of cases from different and more countries, just it was like kind of astonishing in some on some of the calculations, just almost the exact same down to several decimal places figure.
It's wild. You're looking at 2,000 brand new cases. They're completely different than the 2,000 cases you looked at the year before. And somehow almost the exact same percentage comes out with certain findings. It's just, to me, it's been wild, but it's very, very cool to see.
Yeah. And so when you've got that level of consistency across reports, it really does feel like that over the years through this process, we have managed to really like arrive at some truths about fraud through like a scientific method of, kind of proving these things. So some of the other things that Andy hadn't mentioned on those consistent findings, we also emphasize talking about red flags of fraudsters and profiles of fraudsters are the perpetrators. And there have definitely been some consistencies there that are really important for, the anti-fraud profession. Some of those red flags, every report, the most consistently reported red flag associated with a fraud scheme was the perpetrator living beyond their means. And so, that's really important for just awareness within an organization to, the different kind of indicators and things to pick up on. So that one's always number one. And then even the top eight or so stay pretty consistent. And those can be important for, incorporating into detection methods. And like I said, just awareness of the anti-fraud culture at an organization. And then also, the profiles or the different types of fraudsters and the losses they cause. Every single time, some of the largest or the, as far as like a level of the fraudster within the organization, the owners and executives always cause the most costly frauds on a median, average or by median losses. And then men consistently at all levels cause higher losses than women. Although we did have one category at the employee level for the first time ever in this report where the average or the median loss caused by women was higher than men. And I think
only so a little bit, but I feel like there's a
fairly. But
I don't know if I should feel proud or not, right? Like, are we catching up or is that a bad thing? I don't know. But yeah, so it was interesting to see that slight shift this year for the first time.
Yeah. And then also the other one, there are people that have been there the longer that people have been at an organization when they commit fraud, the higher that the losses is going to be. And that's been these categories or these findings have been consistent across all of the reports. And also as well, in terms of types of fraud, asset misappropriation has always been the most common and financial statement fraud has always had the biggest financial impact. So Those are, you know, our kind of axioms of fraud that we've landed on over the years with this report.
Well, and I think in addition to that, we are seeing some pretty interesting new things this year. You know, we noticed a lot of those consistencies, but I'd love to share a few of the newer angles that we either looked at or new trends that we saw. I think one of the things that I was most interested in this year, so we look at cases that were investigated in the prior 2 years of the study. So the cases in this study were investigated between January 2021 and September 2023, whenever they took the survey, between July and September. Yeah. Sorry, I was thinking about our survey timeline. I apologize. And because the typical fraud lasts about a year and a half, that means most of these cases of fraud actually occurred during COVID lockdown period. So we're looking at frauds that were happening sometime between 2019 and 2021. Which gives us a really interesting body of frauds to examine. And so we kind of dove deep a little bit in terms of, are we seeing any blips? Are we seeing anything that kind of jumped out as different this time? And we did. To me, one of the most interesting and potentially impactful things that we saw this time is that we had been observing the median loss caused by frauds going down and the time to detect frauds going down for the last several studies, over the last 10 years. Each of our reports had a slightly lower median loss and a slightly quicker time to detect the frauds. In our 2024 study, time to detect frauds still stayed pretty low, but the median loss actually jumped up 24%. So what that looks like is that during COVID, people stole more faster. And we can hypothesize all sorts of reasons why that was, whether it was less oversight, people working from home, more stress and more uncertainty leading people to feel greater pressure. But the cases in our current study basically were just more costly than they had been in prior years, which is really interesting to see after that trend reversal. We also saw that we had been seeing more collusive fraud, more frauds involving more than one perpetrator in prior years, and that slightly changed as well in our current study, which, you know, more fraudsters were, it seems like not only were they maybe stealing faster, more of them were working alone, which is kind of interesting. So I think, you know, we're kind of now seeing finally the picture of what impact the pandemic had on occupational fraud. 53% of the cases in our study did have at least one pandemic-related factor directly involved in the fraud itself. So we know that we're now really getting that snapshot. We've been kind of hypothesizing as a profession for a few years now about, okay, we think these are the things that happened. We think this is what we were seeing sort of anecdotally, but now our data is actually showing what the impact of the pandemic was on occupational fraud risk.
Yeah, and another area that we took a closer look at this year that's in one of the amazing infographics that our design team does just such a great job with was the impact of fraud awareness training. So when organizations offer or require their employees to undergo fraud awareness training, we wanted to take a look at how much of an impact that has. And our findings indicated that it does have a significant impact on lowering the median losses caused and making it, you know, or shortening the time that the frauds occurred or before they were detected, and particularly when that training is offered to employees at the owner or executive level. So, you know, it was really cool to be able to illustrate that making the employees of your organization aware of different fraud risks and how fraud can occur and what it looks like and what to do when you see it really does have a quantifiable impact on how much fraud affects your organization. So highly encourage everybody to take a look at that section. Then also, I have to take a shot at myself here a little bit because in the 22 report, for the first time ever, we asked a question about whether or not cryptocurrency was involved in the fraud that was, you know, being reported as part of the survey. And you know, the first, when we asked it in 2022, the results showed that 8% of the cases submitted involved cryptocurrency in some form or fashion. And I think I did, you know, some, the usual interviews after these come out and talking about it in a couple different places and basically guaranteeing people that that figure was going to continue to go up. Well, guess what? This year, the second time that we asked that question, it went down from 8% to 4%. So that's egg on my face, I guess. But happy to take credit for that, you know, bad prognostication there.
I still think it's interesting, though, and I don't know that you were, I mean, I think a lot of people were hypothesizing the same as you, that we would start to see a lot more crypto involvement in employee frauds, and I was actually very surprised to see it go down to 4%. I thought for sure we'd see more cases. And, you know, these are things like, did the fraudster misappropriate cryptocurrency? Did they take bribes in some sort of cryptocurrency? Did they convert their stolen funds to cryptocurrency? So certainly I thought with all of those options, we would see some increases. And nope, I was also wrong, Mason. I'll sit right there in the penalty box with you on that one. I also hypothesized incorrectly.
Yeah, well, you can't get them all right, huh? Yeah. You know, that's the danger of prognostication. Another thing that we found noteworthy that was a departure from previous years is that for reporting mechanisms, which we cover in the report because it's so important to, you know, show the audience, our audience, what are the most effective or most commonly used mechanisms that people use to report fraud, since, as we mentioned before, every single time the most effective or most common way that fraud is detected is through tips. So this year, web-based reporting mechanisms were the most commonly used in the frauds in our study. The last study, it was email-based reporting mechanisms. And then prior to that, it had always been telephone hotlines.
Always telephone.
And so, you know, that's not necessarily a surprising development, but we did think it was worth noting as people are designing or implementing improvements or adjustments to their reporting protocols, it's important to include a web-based option because that is our findings suggest that that is what people are most commonly using. So,
well, I think anyone that knows teenagers now and knows those that are going to be entering the workforce in the next 10 years knows that telephone line. I'll make a new hypothesis. I bet telephone continues to decline. I think a lot of the younger folks entering the workforce would rather do just about anything than pick up a phone and make a phone call. So I think that web-based reporting will go up. I think hopefully organizations start creating app-based options and things like that that really do provide mechanisms that kind of meet the newer digital native crowd where they're at. But it was interesting to see it play out, absolutely, with that shift.
Yeah, and then there was one other thing that we wanted to highlight as far as what's different in this version of the report than some of the prior years and how the information was presented, more so than what the findings were. And that was, you know, I've mentioned median losses a couple times at this point, and that is most of the data that you see in the report in the charts and graphs is going to be focused on median losses. But for the first time, we did more prominently featured some information about average losses, and I'll let Andy kind of explain the thought process behind that.
Yeah, I'm glad to kind of dive in and be the data nerd here. So we've used median forever because it is a really good representation of what a typical fraud looks like. We have some really large cases in our study. And frankly, the averages tend to be weighted very highly because of those large cases. So usually when we're trying to paint the picture of what does occupational fraud look like for most instances, we use that median and say, this is, you know, this is what you would expect to see. That said, we also know it doesn't really give a good sense of the potential significance of this risk. We've got almost a quarter of the cases in our study caused over $1 million in losses. And so when we're looking at a median loss of $145,000, it doesn't seem quite as weighty as knowing that a quarter of them hit that seven-figure mark. So we put the averages in there too, so that those who wanted to really better identify the significance really understand the breadth of risk right? And we not only just the averages, we also put 75th and 25th percentiles for those of you nerds like me who want to really dive in and understand the full range of the numbers. We wanted to give users that opportunity to really say, okay, if I'm making a case to my management, they need to understand how much really is at risk here. Typical fraud is this, but a whole lot of them cause a lot more damage than that. So we can't just sit back and say, oh, it's only $145,000. That's fine. You know, we can absorb that. The reality is there's a lot more that can be lost. And that 145 is still one case at a time. You could be having multiple cases happening at any given time. So really trying to give all of our users tools to better communicate about the size of the risk that occupational fraud poses.
Sure. And that's a good, you know, kind of segue into one other thing that's a little bit different this year in the report. And that is for the first time, we actually included some information in the report about how you can use the report and its findings in your role as an anti-fraud professional. And so, you know, we'll walk through some of those. Now we could, Andy and I could sit here and nerd out about all the different numbers in the findings for much more time than you are willing to listen. So you can go find out all that stuff in the report and, you know, shoot either one of us an email if you want to set up a time to really nerd out about it or something. But in the interest of your time, we're going to just kind of highlight that different element and some of the applications for this information before we let you get on with the rest of your day. Andy, I'll let you kind of kick it off
there. Yeah, this is an interesting thing, Mason. And it was one of those when we came up with the idea of like, gosh, why haven't we always done this sort of thing? But I think the reality is, you know, we mentioned the 1996 version of the report had like 11 pages in it. We're now up to over 100 pages. And we know that those users or readers who might be new to it could maybe get lost. And we wanted to give them sort of a roadmap. So we've created a one-page resource that really gives instructions on how to use the report findings. And it includes things like how to use our data in your risk assessments. And it'll point you directly to the charts and graphs that are most relevant. You know, what departments present the highest risks? What types of fraud schemes are the highest risk in your industry? You can also use it to benchmark your programs and compare your controls and your level of hotline detection and all sorts of other metrics to see how your program stacks up. Mason, what else would you recommend people use the report for?
So another thing that we recommend people use this for, and what we kind of touched on in talking about the averages and providing more context for situations where people are trying to sell their management or their clients on the value or the potential impact of things like different types of controls or different things in detection and prevention, and illustrate very clearly based on quantifiable findings like that these things do make an impact and can decrease your exposure to fraud losses or the impact that fraud has on your organization when it inevitably does occur. And like we said earlier, another thing in terms of selling management on the value of certain preventive or detective measures, that fraud awareness training element, you know, that's pretty low cost investment in your anti-fraud program or your organizational culture to just make people aware of some of these things. And especially when you look at kind of the return on that investment, and not just the fraud awareness training, but the other controls as well. It, you know, nobody has an unlimited budget, and their organizations have to make tough choices on what they do and don't invest in. And so you can take some of those pages in this report that talk about organizations that had a control in place versus ones that didn't, and the difference in the median fraud losses that they suffered, and really pinpoint what is going to likely give you the most return on your investment or be worth prioritizing in your anti-fraud program.
Well, and we get that question all the time, right? Is how do I prove the ROI on my anti-fraud investments? And it's hard because you can't really prove the amount of what you've prevented. But the report does give you some very clear tools and guidance to say, this is what it looks like for organizations that do invest. This is what it looks like for organizations that don't invest. So I think that's a really good point. Before we wrap up, let's make sure people know where to find all this good stuff. We've got the report itself. We've got all those infographics. We've got that one pager about how to use the report. All of it's available at acfe.com/RTTN, which stands for Report to the Nations. We internally call it RTTN so often that I forget not everyone knows what that means. So acfe.com/RTTN, you can find the report and all sorts of additional resources there.
The report is now at the link mentioned. Go dive in, take a look at all the fun stuff in there. Send us any questions that you have, and or just let us know what you think of the report. And you know, we appreciate, again, all the people that took time to send us this information that became the report, all the people on our end that were involved in turning all those survey responses into this beautiful report, and all of you for listening to this podcast to learn more about it. And thank you, Andy, for joining me for this conversation. Thanks, everyone, for listening. You can find this podcast along with all our other ACFE podcasts anywhere you get your podcasts, whether that's acfe.com, Spotify, iTunes, and, you know, feel free to subscribe, like, and let us know what you think. But this has been Mason Wilder, and signing off.